Movies and Booze. I'm Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
Yes, it is time for Movies and Booze. In the studio with us, Fionnuala Jones, Chris Wasser and Mick O'Connell, the owner of Neighbourhood Wines, the absolute best wine shop in the country, nay, in the continent of Europe. Good afternoon to you all.
Hi, guys.
What reasonably priced but delicious wines are you going to talk to us about today, Mick?
So we have two southern Italian wines. We've got one from Sicily, from a producer called Planeta. And Planeta are super forward-thinking Italian producers. They produce local varieties, which this is a Grio or Grillo, and Planeta do local and international. They do an amazing Burgundian style Chardonnay as well. But this is quite a crisp, zippy style of white. We also have a wine called Passo del Cardinale, so the passage of the cardinal, from a producer called Paolo Leo. And I've just found out that it's a joke between Paolo, the owner of this winery, and the local priest. He used to refer to him as Cardinal.
Okay. I don't know, Passage of the Cardinal? That's there's not such a place as you could go with that one.
Wow. Well, maybe let's not go that particular direction. That there. But this is a big, rich red.
Yeah, okay. Nothing like I'm going to joke with your local priest. Right, so the two movies today... Are we in that kind of there's a slight pause in before, you know, there may be Gladiator hasn't come out yet and, you know, the big guns haven't come out yet.
Yeah, that's true. We are looking at a horror today, but it's not going to be as scary as that comment you just made. but yeah, there is a little bit of there's a bit of a dip. I suppose like the beginning of October is a little bit like the beginning of January. In a few weeks' time, we might get some horrors. We might start to see some blockbusters. Then we'll get our Wickeds and Gladiators, and then there'll be Christmas films, and then we'll be in the award season. So at the minute, we get a Salem's Lot remake. So that should give you an idea of what's in what the.
How many times has that been remade?
It's actually. Yeah, there hasn't been that many of them. So there was the TV series, the miniseries with David Soul in the 1970s, released as a miniseries in America and then marketed as a film, or actually pieced together as a film for European territories. There was another one with Rob Lowe around 2004. Oh, and yeah, Rob Lowe, love. Stephen King, love. Don't want to see them together.
Yeah.
Don't think they fit. So this is actually just the third. Wow. Forget my comment at the beginning. But have you seen the David Soul version?
If I have, I can't remember.
Look, the David Soul version, it put me off Windows. It just gave me a thing about my bedroom window as a kid. I'll go into that later when I'm reviewing it.
Okay, that sounds
genuinely
traumatic.
Terrifying. So I went into this expecting an awful lot. And then the other film we're going to be looking at is King Frankie, which is an Irish drama, it fancies itself as a bit of a crafty Celtic tiger tale, but it's a story about a man who used to have it all and is still getting used to not having it anymore. And Peter Coonan is in it.
Okay, all right. It sounds like I've heard that story before.
Yeah, a little bit,
being unfair? Yeah. Niall wants to know, could you ask a wine expert, could he advise of anywhere I could get Australian beers? Wine expert. That's the hint in the name there, Niall.
I do know a good place there.
Oh, do you? No. Yeah, there you go.
McHugh's, who have fantastic world beers, but they'll have things like Cooper's and stuff like that from us.
Yeah. Okay.
And Redmond's in Ranelagh as well, depending on where you're located. Bradley's in Cork.
Okay. There you go. There's an answer to your question. Right. There's a Pride and Prejudice series in the works?
Yes.
Yeah.
There sure is, because we haven't seen that one
before.
No
spoilers. I don't want to know what happens in the end.
Yeah. So this is coming to Netflix. We don't have any cast attached yet, but it's Dolly Alderton writing the script. So she did Everything I Know About Love, which is kind of like a very buzzy half memoir kind of stories about love, stuff like that. And I think she did have a novel out last year called Good Material. So I actually hadn't realised that it was her taking over this. And now that I've read this, I am kind of more intrigued. Like, huge shoes to fill, though, when you consider the cast that has like come before this, especially when you're looking at the likes of, you know, Mr. Darcy having previously been played by Matthew McFadyen in the 2005 film and Colin Firth in the 1995 miniseries. So like, who is Mr. Darcy in 2024 / is probably about 2025, 2026 on Netflix? Who is Mr. Darcy now? I was trying to think. Kit Harington? Kit O'Connor? Kit O'Connor, I think, is too young. He's the Heartstopper guy. I don't know. Like, and Matthew McFadyen was so good as Mr. Darcy that I'm kind of like, I don't know how you...
And again,
those boots.
Rather like Salem's Lot. What new can you add to this story? And
Well, the only thing, unless it's like really modernised or something, to which I say, who wants that? Not me, girls. Though Dolly's very talented, and I think if anyone could do it, it is her. But it's just risky. Like, it's, I don't know. I think it's 50-50 as to whether she could stick the landing. And again, it entirely depends on cast as well.
And these stories are always kind of predicated on, you know, there are depths of passion, but you never see them. You might see an arched eyebrow or a trembling wrist, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to completely modernise it, then, you know, everyone's walking around naked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, you already have series that are kind of successfully doing that, like Bridgerton and kind of stuff like that. So I just, I think if they got a really good cast and the script is really good, they'll be fine. I suppose you could say that for anything, but
yeah, absolutely. But there does seem to be a thing about for costume dramas now.
Yeah, there's a real appetite for it. And even just like romance in general, you look at the success of like Nobody Wants This and stuff like that. People are just ravenous for rom-coms and romance on screen and stuff. So,
okay. Did you like Nobody Wants This?
I only started last night. And so far, I think it's good. I think it's perfectly watchable.
Yeah. Okay. That's you think the same, Chris? Perfectly watchable?
I liked it a lot, yeah. I thought the chemistry between Adam Brody and Kristen Bell was terrific. Like, you know, they're quite close. They're friends in real life. I know it was getting an awful lot of flack from people saying, you know, it kind of, it paints a very stereotypical portrayal of American Jewish families, which it does.
All the Jewish women being nasty to her. That took a lot of flack for that.
It is quite strange that all the women are depicted as nagging and just like marriage mad, and then all the guys kind of get off the hook. The guys are kind of presented as bumbling idiots. But I do appreciate like the creators and the cast coming out and saying that, you know, look, we didn't mean to kind of offend anyone here, and that we were just trying to make a heightened comedy. It's not based on, you know, it's not a drama. We are trying to create something that would
make people
laugh.
Of course, but saying we didn't mean to offend anyone. I mean, you know, at some point Donald Trump is going to go, you know, the last 10 years...
Didn't mean it, guys.
Sorry about that. And there's going to be a Princess Diaries 3.
Yes! Woo! I'm so excited.
Okay, that's good news then.
Very exciting. As far as we know, Anne Hathaway is coming back to play the titular princess, Princess Amelia Grimaldi. Oh my God, I'm going to mess up the rest of the names. Thermopolis, Ronaldo.
Well, they're not real people. So
they're not real people.
They're not going to complain.
She's coming back. The director is the person who did Crazy Rich Asians. Adele Lim is her name. Crazy Rich Asians, Joyride. She's worked on TV shows. Said it was an honour to be involved in such a legendary project. I'm going to spoil Princess Diaries 2 now, just in case anyone hasn't seen that. So like, stick your fingers in
your
ears.
Basically,
she can't ascend the throne unless she's married. So it's this whole thing of like her and the granny, Julie Andrews, are like, we need to get you with someone. And she ends up getting with Chris Pine. And Chris Pine doesn't know whether he's coming back to this project. He hasn't gotten the call. To which I say, Bob Iger, pick up the phone and ring Chris Pine now. See if we play. Because apparently he wants to do it. So,
did you see he cut his hair though?
Yes.
He was on a talk show the other morning and he cut his hair and he shaved his beard. So that kind of gives you a sign. He's working on something where he needs
to be
a little bit.
No, he is waiting by the phone. Like, he's desperate to do it.
Right.
It'll probably be terrible, but I will watch. So, as will so many other people. So.
Well, actually, this is a question I asked the other day, and it comes because there's a line in Nobody Wants This where they talk about hating somebody, and one of the characters says, "Yeah, well, I hate Anne Hathaway, and I don't know her." Why does everybody hate Anne Hathaway? What did she do?
Was it that she was like too sincere? People thought, or I don't hate Anne Hathaway.
As I've said previously, I think it was a combination of Les Mis and people feeling weird about that adaptation and her in that specific role, her sincerity around being in the role and her hosting the Oscars. And I think it was like a perfect storm of just being too overexposed, too sincere, too trying to be funny, a combination of all those things. But I think people have come back around to her now, as they should, because she's great.
Yeah. Making great films again.
I never really understood it. Okay, let's move on to our first wine of the day. Tell us, man.
So this is a white wine from Sicily. It's from a producer called Planeta. And this particular wine is called Terrabinto, which is a plant that is grown all across the Mediterranean, but particularly in Sicily, and it's the flower on the pistachio nut.
Oh, okay.
So it's named after what is in the kind of the local area here. This is kind of southwest of Sicily. Like Sicily now probably is most famous for Mount Etna, which is on the eastern side.
Hmm.
But you have this really, really rich culture in Sicily a lot to do with the amount of times that it's been taken over and kind of it's been crusades, the home of the jumping off point for a lot of that. So you have this cultural melting pot and then you add in this land of kind of fertility for growing like fruit trees and nut trees, as we just said. Almonds are a specialty, pistachio. But Griot is the grape in this, G-R-I-L-L-O. So it's probably Grillo as opposed to Griot. But it used to be a very kind of neutral, quite basic grape variety. And they used to use it in Marsala, the fortified wine, which they would intentionally oxidize. So you're trying to do a lot of winemaking stuff to it to make it interesting. But with viticultural improvement over the last generations, you're seeing now a wine like this that is kind of fruity, fresh, very appealing. Like, I don't know if you've tried this, but it's
lovely.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Like this is very much on trend with the kind of your Albarino type style. There's a little bit of the Sauvignon Blanc thing to it, but without the greenness that you get with Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm.
But yeah, Planeta, the producer, are a world class winery, but they're one of these kind of, so up until very recently, Sicily was this very, very rustic place in terms of how they made wine. All local varieties. A lot of the winemaking technique probably wasn't up to scratch. So you ended up with quite a lot of savoury, kind of meaty style reds and boring whites. And now Planeta are at the forefront of kind of bringing in international techniques to make really clean, appealing, commercially successful, which is important. And the way that they would look at things from a business perspective as well as agriculturally is you need to be sustainable in how you run a business. And they're saying, well, look, we're in a part of Italy that is having huge rural depopulation and urbanization. Everybody's moving to the cities,
yeah,
but nobody wants to work in farms. So they're saying, okay, well, if we introduce all these techniques, we're bringing in new jobs, we're kind of building our own little economy. So it's a sustainability from a business perspective, from a kind of cultural people perspective, as well as organically grown grapes.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting.
Not just a delicious wine.
Yeah, there's a whole story there. Right, and it's lovely. Absolutely lovely. Right, so Chris, which movie would you like to talk about?
We'll start with Salem's Lot.
Okay, Salem's Lot coming up after this.
Where's the body?
Okay, fine, I'll go.
There's no stairs.
That's where I saw Barlow get Mr. Burke. There's a ladder outside.
Get your stakes and crosses ready. See anything?
Go lock up your windows. That's Salem's Lot. It's in cinemas now. Only the third remake of it, more or less. Well worth the wait, Chris.
Yeah, definitely. I was asking you earlier if you had seen the original. So the original, so the book was published in 1975, and then the first adaptation was in 1979. Again, as I said, this epic miniseries for American audiences, but Tobe Hooper, who also did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, himself and his team, they edited it into like a 2-hour plus feature for European territory. So I would have seen it as a film on television when I was a kid. And my mom and dad had some very strange rules for what we were and weren't allowed to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember for instance, I wasn't allowed to watch The Exorcist, but I was allowed to read it. Bad idea. Very bad idea.
Whoa.
They showed me Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is one of my favourite films, when I was far too young. And as a result, for a month, I thought Mum and Dad were going to divorce. And then I watched this because Dad loved it when he was younger. And there is a scene in it where, you know, you've got this town where all of the people are slowly but surely being turned into vampires.
Mm.
And it starts with some very young kids. And one of the kids who isn't turned into a vampire is a bit worried about his mates going missing. And he's trying to fall asleep one night and he hears a at his bedroom window.
Okay.
And he looks across and there's his friend floating outside the window saying, "Let me in, let me in." That messed me up for an awful long time.
Yeah,
I was afraid of my bedroom window. If I ever woke during the middle of the night and I heard something outside, there was no way I was going to open those curtains at all.
Yeah.
So going into this, I was like...
How old were you at the time?
Probably still in single digits. Too young to be watching Salem's Lot, I think, Dad.
Okay, all right. There's a cancelling bill there, I think.
Yeah, I was talking to quite a few critics about this going into this remake, and we all agreed that there should be some sort of support group for people who were too young when they saw the original. So I had big expectations, and I think it has big shoes to fill, and I like a few people involved in it, like Gary Doberman was involved in the lucrative It franchise, the first It film there a few years ago, very good, the second one we won't talk about. We've got Lewis Pullman, son of Bill, in the lead, and he's proven himself to be a little bit more than an Nepo baby. Like, he is actually quite a good actor. Not sure if he's leading man material. And you've also got some great character actors in here, like Bill Camp, Alfred Woodard, William Sadler, who's been in a whole load of Stephen King adaptations. So I thought, okay, this is going to be fun. It's not. The story, I will sum up very quickly. It's just about a writer named Ben Mears returning to his hometown of Jerusalem's Lot, or Salem's Lot as the locals call it, in Maine in 1975. As a kid, something terrible happened to him. He's come back to find out a little bit more about this tragedy, maybe write a book, do some research. But he runs into all sorts of distractions. One is that he falls in love with a local woman named Susan who wants to get out of town. She's played by Mackenzie Lee here. And another is that there's a young child gone missing, and then another, and then another. And Ben and all of these people he comes across, whether it's a youngster named Mark or an old school teacher played by Bill Camp, they realize very quickly, like, all of these weird things start happening, and then they go, you know what? Must be vampires. And it is vampires. And
that's usually the explanation for most things.
Yeah. So they take it upon themselves. You've also got like an alcoholic priest in there and a few other kind of creepy characters. It's very strange. They all decide that they're going to take on these vampires and, you know, take back the town despite the fact that everyone's dead or undead. I really, really wanted to like this. Love the look of it. Love the performers. I mean, it is at times like a beautiful looking film.
Yeah.
Which is weird for a horror about vampires, but it's all, you know, sun-drenched 1970s small town America. Like, it's very pretty to look at. But there is a bang off this of something that was very heavily tampered with and shredded in post-production by a studio. And it turns out that that might actually be the case, because it was filmed in 2021 during COVID, scheduled for a 2022 release. So it's been on the shelf for 2 years.
Ooh.
It's been the original cut was over 3 hours long. It's been whittled down to about 110, 113 minutes, something like that. So you have Gary Doberman, the director, saying, yes, the film used to be longer, but we went at it. And they went too far with it, because there are some things that happen in one scene that don't sync up with the events that happen in the next. So you have this thing that just stops making sense after about half an hour. It's just things happening, one thing happening after another. And also you've got this like title sequence at the beginning, which is quite cartoonish. It actually starts very much like a television series. And you've got all this backstory being explained in this animated opening. And you're thinking to yourself, well, that's a bad sign. Obviously, like, if you're squeezing all of the backstory into this animated sequence, then something's clearly gone wrong. So it stops making sense. And I think you'll notice as well after half an hour, if you do go see it, that it has a very patient start. You know, it is introducing characters, it is setting up the story quite nicely, but then it's just bang, jump scare, bang, jump scare, bang, and it's just relentless. And I didn't know while watching it that James Wan produced it, and then a whole lot of guys from the Conjuring universe were involved in it.
Yeah,
and that's what those films are, unfortunately. Like, they're just ghost train movies, you know. They're just designed to just make you jump every 10 seconds. And I think this is one of the original American vampire stories, and that deserves a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
So yeah, great cast. You know, I would have actually taken a 3 hour plus version if that would have made sense.
Yes.
It would have been more entertaining.
Yeah.
But yeah, this has clearly been cut to shreds, and it shows.
Yeah, okay. That's not great then.
No,
go back that way.
Go back and watch the original and tell me that it isn't the freakiest thing you've seen. I mean, I'm sure it's kind of a little bit dodgy. I'm sure it's aged terribly in parts, but that was proper scary. I will say, though, I always know when a horror is effective when I'm at a press screening, because usually, like, in the second half of a film, like, you have to pop out to loo, especially if it's
sure.
2 hours, right?
Yeah.
If I'm watching a really scary horror, when I get down to the loo and if there's no one else in the toilet, I'm freaked out for the 2 minutes. Someone is going to come in and try and kill me any minute.
Yeah, because that happens a lot.
One, I did pop out to the loo during the second half, and it was only when I got back to my seat that I realized that I never thought about it at all. So that's how you know that it's just not working. It's a very weird thing that I have, but that's how I knew it wasn't scaring me.
Totally agree with the Salem's Lot review. It was atrocious, says John. The original is far superior to this tripe. Somebody else says, Salem's Lot freaked the living, this is the original, freaked the living daylights out of me when I saw it. I couldn't stop crying. All my family were laughing at me, saying it was silly. It was only a movie, that it wasn't real, but I was in ribbons. That's parenting in the 1980s, really, yeah. Just get over it. Now, Anne Hathaway, total bitch, as we saw from this from your next story.
Yeah, if anyone remembers, which I can't believe this was this year because it feels like 800 years ago, all the drama around it ends with us and like Blake Lively and there being this kind of wave of backlash against her and how she was promoting the film and stuff like that. And around that time, there was a journalist, a Norwegian journalist called Kirsty Fla, had posted this video about an interview. Basically, it was like, this is the worst interview I've ever done, and it was with Blake Lively. And the context of that interview was Blake was pregnant at the time. It was publicly known that she was pregnant. Kirsty congratulated her, and Blake kind of fired back with, congrats on your bump, and then proceeded to kind of ignore her essentially for the rest of the interview. So everyone was very angry at Blake. She's kind of done something similar again, and I don't know why. I don't know if it's because of the Princess Diaries 3 news and the stuff around The Devil Wears Prada 2 and stuff like that. That it's just Anne Hathaway's in the news. But basically, she has put out this interview from 2012 that she did with Anne Hathaway around the time that they were promoting Les Mis. And Kirsty was doing this thing where she was, when she was sitting down with the actors, she was singing her questions to the actors, right? To make it kind of different and to make it stand out, right? Okay. And because Les Mis is a musical.
Lost all sympathy.
Yeah, do we see where it's going here? And everyone played along bar Anne Hathaway, right? And you see it in the video. And I will say, initially, Anne seems very like polite. She says, well, I won't be doing that, but you're more than welcome to sing. Basically saying that I'm not going to sing my responses back to you, whatever. Mm. And then the rest of the interview is a bit awkward. It's a bit one word answers, whatever. She posts this. Anne Hathaway gets wind of this, as does her publicist. They get straight on to her, essentially Kirsty, to apologise. Kirsty didn't go into the details of what she said, but said it was a very personal message and that she appreciated it. But like, from my perspective, and I know people love when celebrities are assholes and stuff like that, and I don't doubt that people have many, and journalists have many stories of people being rude, and at the end of the day, journalists are just there to do a job as well. Why did she post this again now? It's weird one-upman... Ship kind of a thing, an interview that nobody else remembered bar her. And I get, again, that must have not been a great experience for her. Just a bit weird. I don't know.
She was just looking for attention. Plus the fact, if she's had a terrible interview with Blake Lively and a terrible interview with Anne Hathaway, maybe she's not a great interviewer.
Well, like, there is also that as well. I'm like, are you kind of ratting on yourself here by posting this one as well? You know, I don't know, like. And I think she had a lot of people on side with the Blake Lively thing. This, while again, I don't think Anne is at her most polite. I think not wanting to sing back the answers, fair enough. She couldn't protect her voice. Yeah. Anything, like, there's a myriad of reasons. I get wanting to stand out in junkets and trying to do something silly, funny, but like, it's with, like, her response was fine. Like, completely fair to be like, if you want to do that brand, I'm going to talk.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, yeah. Well, no, but didn't she get kind of, she got this apology from Anne Hathaway, though, for more attention for her, and Anne Hathaway saying, she might get some sort of favouritism the next time Anne Hathaway is interviewing for something.
Maybe, yeah. Well, I don't know if Anne Hathaway is ever going to speak to her. I think you can apologise and just be like, to make sure she never comes into a junket again.
Or
you know what I mean?
Could see like that people who organise these junkets are going to go, make sure your woman, Kirsty Fla, isn't there.
Yeah.
Because no one wants that hassle.
No, definitely not.
An adaptation of The Housemaid.
Yes, this isn't a novel that I'm familiar with, but it's very popular. It's by Freida McFadden. It's being adapted. Sydney Sweeney and Amanda Seyfried are going to star in it. Paul Feig is directing. He did Bridesmaids and A Simple Favour. It's a psychological thriller. Sweeney plays Millie, a struggling young woman who gets a fresh start as a housemaid to a wealthy couple, Nina and Andrew. Andrew's been cast yet, as far as I know, where Amanda Seyfried is playing Nina. But obviously Millie soon learns that the family has secrets that we never knew about.
Oh, wow.
So that is coming.
Never happens.
Yeah, never happens. It'll be interesting to see the two of them. They're very similar looking. So I'm wondering if that, again, if you know the novel, then I'm sure there must be something to do with that in terms of the plot. But it was when I was seeing all the articles about them being cast together, I was like, they are twins. It's crazy.
Maybe one of them will have to wear a hat.
Maybe.
All the way
to differentiate.
The film. A beret or something. Moving on to our red wine.
So this is a red from Puglia. So Puglia is the heel of Italy, if you will. And this part is, it's called Manduria. So it's Primitiva di Manduria and it's just north of Gallipoli. But the grape variety here is Primitivo, which is quite a big, bombastic, rich kind of style of red. Mm. And it was funny, while we were off air, we all stuck our noses into it and everyone kind of went, Like as in, it is a bit of a hug of a wine, if you know what I mean. And I think this will appeal to people who love kind of Amarone, Ripasso, that kind of style, because it is big, rich, plush. Here you've got quite early picking, actually. So they pick first week of September. The reasoning for that, like it's still 14% of alcohol. The reason that they're picking early-ish and maintaining that level of alcohol is because it's so dry in the south of Italy now. Mm. For the last, since around 2020, they've basically been constantly in drought. So this is, and both Puglia, Calabria, all of the south have really bad water problems at the moment. So it's like they're seeing the kind of brunt of climate change in Italy. Sicily that we had previously, it has been slightly different, but has had drought as well. So you're really, it's interesting when we were talking about Planeta earlier and looking into sustainability, the way things are going for farmers in the south, they need to really be starting to think outside the box as to where they're going to plant, etc., because of all the natural phenomenon that are coming at them yearly to basically stop them growing grapes.
And having to pick them early then, what effect does that have on the wine itself?
So if you pick earlier, you maintain acidity. And like acidity sounds like a dirty word, have you reaching for a Rennie and Gaviscon? But acidity is the thing in food and drink that kind of refreshes the palate. So it's like you have a sip and if you want to go back for more, it's because your palate has kind of been wiped clean. I always talk about acidity in terms of like a tomato salad. So you have like green tomatoes, yellow tomatoes, red tomatoes. And the reason that you do that balance is to try and get some acid, which is the green tomatoes, and some sweetness, which is the red tomatoes. And you're trying to just hit that balance. So you get this kind of sweet sour thing.
Yeah.
But it maintains acid, which means it maintains refreshingness. But it also it has lower booze than what it would have. The alcohol percentage is lower than what it would be if they, with this, if they even waited another 2 weeks, you'd be at 15.5-16 degrees alcohol.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, you have a very, very different style of wine. Like this is something, because of the acid, you could go back for a couple of glasses. But if the alcohol was higher and there was no acid, it would be a tiring wine to have.
Mm.
Spends 3 months in American oak and you have this real kind of like vanilla sweetness to the front of the palate.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
And then you have this nice dry tannin as well. So you have this kind of sweet and dry thing, which makes it very, very good food pairing, particularly kind of meats. This is like ultimate barbecue wine.
Yeah.
And really, really good value as well. This is 22 quid. And Primitiva di Manduria is kind of the top region for Primitivo.
Yeah. Like, because Primitivo is very common. Like, how many parts of Italy would it be grown in?
To be honest, mainly in the south and mainly Puglia. The reason that it's very common is Puglia traditionally has been one of the workhorse areas for Italy, as in they produce a lot of wine.
Yeah. Can you ask Mick if Paul Masson wine is still available in Ireland? Can't find it anywhere, Michael wants to know.
I have not seen that for ages. That was the one that you used to be able to turn into a vase afterwards and put your flowers into.
Yeah.
Kind of carafe style.
Yes, yeah.
I haven't seen that in ages.
Yeah, maybe it's gone. Lisa in Dublin 7 says, my dad let me watch Hush Sweet Charlotte with Bette Davis when I was 9. And I was so terrified that two scenes stuck with me to this day. I still haven't been able to watch it and I'm 53 now.
Yeah. It's weird what our parents allowed us to watch it.
Yeah. That's probably not good news for you that the damage is permanent.
Oh, the damage really is permanent.
Oh, God.
Yeah, you better believe it.
Saoirse Ronan was almost Luna Lovegood.
Yeah, I didn't know this. Maybe this is more common than I thought, but she's on the promo trail because she's in The Outrun and she's in that other movie that's out now from Steve McQueen. I think Blitz. It's called Blitz. Yeah. So she's doing the promo and she says the one role that kind of like evades her, the one role she kind of wish she got was Luna Lovegood, which obviously went to fellow Irish actor Evanna Lynch. She's talked about it, just seeing it on screen and just being like, God, I wish I got that. Also this week, because she's been talking to people, there were loads of rumours that she turned down the role for Yelena in the Marvel spin-off Black Widow. Again, if you know, it was Florence Pugh got the role in the end. And she kind of hasn't, she's kind of all but confirmed it that she was offered it and basically turned it down. But she'd said, I can't see myself doing Marvel. I don't. I would prefer to do Bond. But also went on to say, like, there's nothing wrong with Marvel. I think she just doesn't want to do it, which I think is fair and kind of savvy from her part. Because
yeah.
I don't think she should go anywhere near the franchises because she's very good at what she does in terms of characters and stuff like that. Bond, though, I am a bit intrigued, and I wonder, does she mean Bond girl, or does she mean just Bond?
Oh, I couldn't see her. She'd be a villain. She'd be a good villain.
Yeah, she would. She would.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. No, I couldn't see her being a Bond girl, nor would I think she'd agree to it.
No. Whatever, but could she be Bond?
Yeah.
You know, with the way they're talking about Bond.
Yeah. Maybe she'd be a 007 kind of, or 008, or, you know, one of those. Yeah.
I'd love to see it, but we've no word on the new Bond yet.
Ivana Lynch, where is she now?
She does a lot around. She's a vegan, like, beauty box subscription company and a couple of other things. She's a good old entrepreneur doing bits.
Okay, so. But she's not acting.
In terms of acting, I'm not 100% sure. I feel like no, but I don't want to wrong her. So she has the right of a player if she does want to text in. But I think she's occupying herself with other things as far as I'm aware.
Okay, well, no, fair juice to her. But just, it's because was that role supposed to go to an Irish actor?
I'm not sure, actually.
Is Luna Lovegood?
No,
Irish?
I don't think she's Irish. She's not Irish in the book, but it is just interesting that it got down to two blonde Irish girls who could play weird, you know? So, there you go.
Saoirse can kind of afford to let another Irish actor around her age have a go.
Yeah.
Seems a bit greedy, really. Right, we'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is King Frankie. Here's a clip.
I used to be king before this. They used to call me King Frankie. I got my new business now, and it's a fair one, you know.
You're a taxi man.
It's been a long time, Dad. Don't beat yourself up.
Sorry I'm late.
Like the royal wedding, Frankie.
You only turn 8 once. King be mine.
Fraser, can we have a chat?
Yeah, what about the proposal I sent you?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look at this.
I don't want to put you under too much pressure, but...
Fraser! Right in the bollocks.
Hard to beat, right?
Since when did you hang around with a bunch of chancers like that, huh?
Seal, when are you going to be here? You're upset.
I'm upset, am I?
Give me my money.
You already owe me money, Frank.
Seal, I just need a bit of time.
I don't know what's going on with your life and what kind of mess you're in, but this place, none of it's real.
Look, I have it under control, Dad. I've got a plan.
Okay, right, so we get the gist of that somebody's life is going off the rails now.
It is. A little bit, yeah. There are two stories here in King Frankie, but you have Peter Coonan playing the one character, but he gets to play two sides of him because part of the story takes place in 2019 and then 10 years before that. And he is playing this guy named Frank, who in 2019 is a Dublin taxi firm owner. And by the looks of it, you know, a good egg who's been through maybe an awful lot. And himself and his wife are living with his parents, but his dad, played by Owen Rowe. So here you have like Peter Coonan and Owen Rowe, like two actors who are very much prominent stage actors, who I don't think have ever had like a screen role worthy of their talents. But I think that changes with this film. So his dad has just died and it's the day of the removal and there's just an awful lot going on. There's an early morning job. There's a maybe a promising, but maybe a little bit dodgy business venture going on. There's some broken friendships that need mending. And then, of course, there's, you know, a dad that requires burying. So this guy has an awful lot going on. He does not expect for a friend or an old friend from his past to arrive on his doorstep. And that just brings up an awful lot of traumatizing kind of memories for Frankie, who 10 years before that was, you know, at one point a thriving businessman, but kind of running on fumes. I mean, this is like, it's a bit of a Celtic Tiger tale. The business that Frankie obviously had, we don't really know what it was. The film kind of just leaves a few details a little bit sketchy. But clearly he'd run into some money issues. And it all went down and his life blew up at his daughter's 8th birthday party bash. And this is an 8th birthday party that you have never seen the likes of before. It's in a hotel. It's a little bit, you know, it's far too extravagant for a kid. It's more of a party for the adults. You know, you have Frankie in the middle of it kind of stressing out because the cake is not big enough. It was supposed to be chocolate and it's vanilla. And clearly he's very stressed about some sort of business deal, the same as in the present, some sort of business deal not working out. But he's about to, I think he's maybe like banked everything he has on it. Mm. So you know that on this day 10 10 years ago, his whole life is about to blow up, and something to do with a friend that he might have gone into business with that he's fallen out with. And then in the present, his whole life is still kind of affected by that day, and also his dad has died. So he's just trying to get through both of these days without any further disasters happening. But, you know, that's not going to.
Yeah,
there are going to be.
Okay, well, it's an interesting structurally. Yeah. That's an interesting concept.
I think so. Yeah, and Peter Coonan has played again. But up until this, I don't think he's ever had like a role on screen worthy of his talents, other than, you know, obviously everyone goes back to Fran and Love Hate, which he was very good at. But with this, because he has that sort of dual role happening, where, you know, he gets to play this, you know, slippery, you know, morally corrupt chancellor in the first part, you know, with the Celtic Tiger era stuff, and then in the other one, a man who clearly has the weight of the world on his shoulders and has been through an awful lot. Well, he gets to Coonan, that is, gets to show us what he's made of. And yeah. I think this is the first time that I've ever come away from a screen role of his going, that guy is terrific. And he really is. He's holding all of this in place here. And Owen Rowe is, you know, he is always quite good, but he's very good here as the dad character who just constantly pulls him aside in that past story and says, son, you need to, you know, calm down here and I can help you. So the two of them work very well together. I'd like to see them more on screen. I do think, though, despite the fact that there are some entertaining moments and, you know, Peter Coonan is working very hard in those flashbacks, I think it would probably be a better film without it, because the problem with having two stories like that is you keep spoiling your momentum all the time. You know, you kind of like you're with Frankie throughout the present and you want to know a little bit more about him, but you don't want the film to hammer it home. You don't want to spell it out for you and to hold your hand. But at the same time, this is from a first time feature filmmaker named Dermot Malone. I think for a first time feature, it's very impressive. It's ambitious. It's got big ideas, big themes. It has a big heart too. Some lovely music in there. Yay Vagabonds are on the soundtrack. It's a little bit rusty. It's a little bit creaky, but it's, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what Dermot does next. And I'd like Peter Coonan to focus on the screen acting again, because he is tremendous here.
Okay, and this is in cinemas as well?
This is in cinemas from today, yeah. So, okay. Yeah, a flawed but fascinating film.
Fantastic. My parents brought me to see Kramer versus Kramer in Dublin, but we couldn't get in. So we went to the Amityville Horror instead.
Oh my God.
Like, what's wrong with your parents?
You're not comparable films. Like, what?
Both films are going to make you worry about your mom and dad.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. One about mommy and daddy splitting up. The second one about mommy and daddy body parts all everywhere. Anyway, I remember that scene with the floating kid. Same thing. I was 7. And it freaked me out for years. So did the American Werewolf in London. Every time a dog howled at night.
We are so traumatized
from that. Funny enough, I remember American Werewolf in London, but I don't remember that. I remember Jenny Agutter in the shower. I was maybe at a different life stage at that point. There's going to be another Big Bang spin-off.
Let These Die. We were just released from the vice grip of Young Sheldon literally this year, and they've said, you know what, let's do it again. And I do kind of understand it, because it is such a, like, it's a genuine ratings juggernaut. And even with Young Sheldon, it's one of the last kind of, maybe not even necessarily here, but over in the States, like, it pulled in like such consistent viewership. And it's one of the last big like network shows. But anyway, this spin-off is going to focus on, if you watched The Big Bang Theory, it focuses on the characters Stewart, Denise and Bert, who were like around the comic book shop that the guys used to shop at. Enjoy, I suppose, if you want that again. And I'm glad those actors are gainfully employed, but
we'll
let this universe die, maybe, question mark.
Well, I don't know. They're still doing less than Marvel stuff, so.
Is that a compliment, though?
I don't know if it is. really. Anyway, Fanula, Chris and Mick, thank you all very much. That's our lot.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief
with Marks and Spencer
on News Talk.